The Senate Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. It's Thursday, March 13th, 2008, and we're going to start with Senator Skoy. Senator Skoy, welcome to our committee.
You know, Madam Chair, I think this is the first time I've been before the Commerce Committee, so I'm happy to be here.
Everybody loves it, so.
Chair.
Right. You did have the Power Hour bill, you know, but we were in room 15. I remember that hearing.
That's right.
You're right.
That's
so you were with us before. But.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 3061 is a bill that does three things. Section 1 deals with cost recovery, and what we're attempting to do here is have the cost recovery go to the Petro Fund Board instead of going through the PCA and then to the Petro Fund Board. PCA and Petro Fund are supportive of this and are here if you have questions. Section 2 and Section 4 repealer are provisions in law that have already sunsetted, so we're just cleaning up some language. Section 3 is the part that I'd like to spend just a little bit of time talking about. There are instances where homeowners have moved diesel fuel tanks or for any other reason have done modifications to their fuel oil tanks that they use to run their furnaces to heat their homes, and they put some plastic PVC piping in their fill lines or perhaps the supply line to the furnace. The diesel fuel eats away at the glue that puts those joints together, and they develop leaks. What we're seeing is a number of the homeowners insurance companies are putting fuel oil exclusion endorsements on the policy so that they won't cover these plastic lines. So we've worked out some language with the Petro Fund that we think will be pretty good in getting these PVC pipes removed from the house. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have an amendment. Copy of it here. It doesn't have a number on it. A08, I guess, is the number on it.
Senator Skoy, I don't think we have it. And members, we don't have the first engrossment in front of us. We're getting it. So were there amendments to the original bill?
Senator Madam Chair, there was an amendment to the original bill that I can. It was a small oral amendment.
Okay.
On page 1, line 12.
58.
Okay.
To reinstate the stricken language, Attorney General. Add the words on behalf of, so it reads by the Attorney General on behalf of the board.
Okay, and that was the only amendment, so we can work, then we can work with our original copy.
Yes, everything else is the same except for that, Madam Chair. And I think I can do the amendment orally if Senate Counsel would work with me.
Mr. Stang will help us.
What we're doing, Madam Chair, is we're going to put a maximum on the expenditure from the.
Is that on page 2, Senator?
Page 2, section 3. That's putting a maximum expenditure from the Petro Fund of $1,500,000.
So it's going to be additional language.
Yes, and the way this reads is page 2, line 30, deleting 400 and inserting 250.
Delete 400 and make that number $250.
Yes, and after the second period, insert the maximum expenditure from the fund may not exceed $1,500,000.
The maximum expenditure from
the
fund may not exceed
$1,500,000. And I see that the amendments have arrived.
Thank you. Okay. Okay, and we can do this off the original. The bill is introduced. So, yeah. So, and then that new language fits in at the end of line 2.30, right?
Right.
Yes, line 2.30.
Do members understand? I think Senator Metzen probably would like to move that amendment.
I understand it.
In any case, Senator Metzen, we wanted you to move it, but I know you understand it. any discussion on that? Members, you understand they're capping the amount. But the deal is that people will get some assistance with changing the piping, I'm assuming. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what kind of cost that probably is per house.
Madam Chair, it could be different with every different house. Oh. What we are thinking is that $250 will get them a long ways toward getting these lines replaced. It might not cover all the costs, but hopefully, as much as anything, it'll make them aware of the issue, and then they will do this before it becomes a larger problem. If there is a spill in the basement and the homeowner's insurance doesn't cover, I do believe they would be eligible to go to the Petro Fund for reimbursement, which would be much more costly. Okay. And so that's kind of the rationale behind this, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, you understand?
Yep.
No questions?
And, Madam Chair, I do have representatives from the Petro Fund and the agency here if anybody has questions of them.
I think we're fine. Is there anybody who opposes the direction? Actually, he's not. Well, just the additional language.
I'll move the bill.
Okay. Well, Senator Metzen has moved the amendment, the A08 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. And then Senator Metzen would move that Senate File 3061, as amended, be recommended to pass. And
Madam Chair, I think this can go to the floor. I don't believe it has to go anywhere else, but I don't know.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, not on that point, but I did have a question.
Okay, I want Mr. Singh, doesn't have to go to finance because the fund is there. This is just making an expenditure from the fund, authorizing an expenditure.
That's my hope.
Okay. Senator Martin.
Good luck.
Just fondly to be with. Yes, Senator Martin.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoia, I'm sorry I was late, but I'm wondering the logic. What was magical about September 1st, 2011 for an end date?
Senator Scoia.
Picture 2 years, 3 years or something, but that's a...
Senator Marty, maybe I'll bring Mr. Krogman up to help answer that. The language was worked out between distributors and the PCA, and he's asking what's magical about September.
Mr. Krogman, welcome.
Chair, members of this committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. The three-year time period or three-year sunset is... there kind of as an incentive to get it done. Realistically happen is the fuel oil jobbers will be sending out letters every year saying PVC, we've had problems with it, here's how you can replace it, here's part of the solution. Rather than let that go on, we thought in 3 year period it would get more done on a quicker basis.
And Senator Marty, as I'm looking at it, it looks like you intend this to be effective August 1st. So that makes the September date a little more
it's good
understandable.
For,
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, it says from May 1st, 2008, between then and September 1st, so 40 months, but I don't know what was magical about 3 years and 4 months. That's the only question.
It's magic.
It's fine.
It's just magic, it's Senator magic. Marty. You know.
I already know my...
Okay, yes, on... the Metzen motion. Further discussion. Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? I see no one. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails.
Thank
the
you,
bill
Madam.
Is recommended to pass, and it will go to the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Now is Senator Scogin.
Sorry.
We're fine, Senator Scogin. And Senator Scoia probably thanks you for being a little late because then he was able, he didn't have to sit here through what looks like four bills. Five. Senator Scogin and Mr. Bagnoli.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I'm carrying the all-encompassing liquor bill for you today.
Yes, I should tell members that we're going to hear, I think, four bills having to do with liquor, and Senator Scogin's bill 3672 will be the vehicle for those. And Senator Tomasoni knows that. I don't know that Senator Dibble, is Senator Dibble here?
And if I could, Madam Chair, Senator just for the record, if we just could not tell my wife, she's a teetotaler, so if, you know, if she never finds out about this, I'll be okay with that.
Bring us home, Bob.
Senator Scogin, get her on the phone.
What happens here,
okay.
You know,
I appreciate that.
Nothing's on TV.
In the Joe Roulette room, you're fine.
Joe Bagnoli is here to help me as well, and I'm glad he is. He understands what some of these bills look like, and he's here to explain them and why they're before you, Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Bagnoli, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Scogin's bill has to do...
Just say your name for
me. I'm sorry. Joe Bagnoli with McGrann Shea Law Firm on behalf of the State Fair. Senator Scogin's bill makes it what amounts to a technical correction. As you may recall, or it's obviously a little more than that, but as you recall, last year you passed a bill that said that the state fair could sell strong beer. Unbeknownst to us, in a different part of the bill, or in a different part of the law, there's a provision that prohibits the state fair from selling strong beer. So what we're doing is just conforming the intent of last year in making the change in that other section of law.
So, Mr. Bagnoli, 3721 subdivision 2 is just a cross-reference. So they still will be able to do it? I mean, no, they'll be able to do it legally?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the 37.21 subdivision 2 is the section of law where you specified that they could do this last year.
Okay.
And so this, why it was done this way was because this only says strong beer. If you had deleted that entire on the state fairgrounds, you would have allowed for spirits and
okay
all kinds of other things you may not have
intended. Okay, so members understand. I need to ask Mr. Stang then procedurally if this is the vehicle. I mean, we kind of, yeah. I'm sorry, just a second.
Lay it on the table.
Procedurally, do we just lay this on the table then and then?
Yes, Madam Chair, and then we'll move to include other bills.
Into it, and then we vote.
Then we vote on the entire package.
So that's what I thought. So we won't vote right now on.
You can take a test vote, though.
No.
He's
helpful.
So,
it's our friend.
So I think it's probably pretty safe to say, at least I'd certainly make the case, that if this is what we intended to do, we ought to do it correctly. So, and since it's the same suspects as last year, except for Senator Dahl, I think we know what we did.
Madam Chair, I should just note that the state fair, I think they discovered this error. They and the Ramsey County discovered this error after the state fair last year. The state fair actually sold strong beer last year and had no problem. I debated as I opened my mouth.
No,
I think that it's okay.
And we allowed. They do sell wine.
Yes.
There in the horticulture building.
Madam Chair, yes, they do.
Okay. I had a very funny thing happen. I ended up buying a glass of wine at 10 o'clock in the morning because that's when I was in the horticulture building, and the woman started to explain to me about all the wineries in Minnesota, and she said, you know, there's even one up in Plummer, Minnesota.
Not in Plummer, Madam Chair, but
Senator,
right near Plummer, yes.
That's Senator Stumpf's...
Two Fools
Winery.
Winery, yes.
So, anyway.
Suburb of Plummer.
We will lay this over and right now and act on it when we're done with the other bill. So, Senator Tomasoni. Welcome.
Thank you. Liquor bills first? We're dealing with.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think the first one is
Pretty easy, 2924.
2924 regarding St. Louis County, Senator Tomasoni.
This is allowing the Cherry Store to get a liquor license if the county agrees to give them one. And that's about the issue. The county store is on Highway 37. It's farther than 1,500 feet from the school, but if you go through the field and you go through the farmhouse and then you go over the fence and then under a log, you measure it that distance, then it's a little bit less than 1,500 feet. So that's why they haven't been allowed to get the license. And this allows them to get one only in the event that St. Louis County will allow them to have it, because it's permissive for St. Louis County. Mr. Stang, I would also like to add the Township Board as one of the approving authorities. Is that possible?
Senator Tomasoni, you want the county and?
Yes.
The Township Board. Do we?
What?
Do we do that?
That would be a new concept.
Okay, let's not do it then.
Let's not do it.
Mr. Stang, is it counties that usually
in unorganized territory, it's the county board which issues liquor licenses, and cities, it's cities. I'm not aware of any township having any authority over liquor license issuance.
Okay, let's leave it.
Would that be considered, even if it's a township, is that unorganized?
Or, I'm sorry, anything other than a city, the county board.
Okay.
I misspoke.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So that's all it is, ma'am.
And the reason we need to do this, because I think probably, didn't we change this so people didn't have to come here to get authorized liquor licenses? We allowed entities to do X number, but the issue here is the distance to a school.
Yeah.
Okay.
You might want an immediate effective date on this, too.
And Senator Tomasoni, would you like to have an immediate effective date?
Yes, please.
So,
Madam Chair, we just insert after line 10, effective date. This section is effective the day following final enactment.
Do we have to make an amendment to these? Senator Sparks offers that amendment. Is any discussion of that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The the motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. So have an immediate. After enactment?
After
final. Any questions or discussion on the bill?
School board.
Members. Senator Sparks then moves that Senate File 2924, as amended, be recommended to pass and put in to Senator Scogin's Senate File 3672. Would that be the appropriate motion? Discussion. Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to speak concerning this bill? So, all those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And the bill will go into Senator Scogin's bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Tomasoni on the other.
Okay, Senate File 3484 is a little bit more complicated, but I think it's This is applied to our farm winery statute, and what they want to do here is they want to be able to make cognac and brandy out of the fruits that they have on their farm, so that we can have homemade Minnesota-grown cognac and brandy and sell them on retail, off sale, and at stores. And the clause number one. Just what it does is it basically says that since they're limited to 50,000 gallons of wine right now, that if they decide to do this, any amount of cognac or brandy that they do produce will be subtracted from the 50,000 gallon limit, and they have to pay that fee. And then clause number three says they can't sell to a manufacturer. So. It seems to me that it's an attempt to try and allow Minnesota farm wineries to have more products and to sell homemade products in Minnesota. So, and I think that Mr. Stang is working on an amendment that we need to have to add this into the statute so that they The bill says they can make it, but it doesn't say they can sell it, and I think he has to put in it.
They'd have to drink it.
Yeah.
Senator Tomassoni, has anybody from the grape growers organization or association contacted you?
I haven't heard from anybody.
My concern would be just that we don't intertwine this with what the farm wineries are already able to do, but it sounds like you're consistent with that. I asked Mr. Stang, first of all, go ahead and tell me, this doesn't interfere, does it, with...
It's an addition, Madam Chair, to farm winery authority.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, if they make up the 5,000 gallons of this, but they have to subtract it from the 50,000 gallon limit.
And current law allows 50,000.
Right. Correct.
It's okay.
Sure.
And Mr. Stang is going to... you're going to present an amendment. Okay.
To make this consistent with how farm wineries can sell the other products they currently make, I would suggest on line 12, after the period, insert a sentence that reads, "The distilled spirits authorized under this subdivision may be sold by the farm winery at on-sale or off-sale, in retail, or in wholesale lots."
You say that again. I'm sorry.
Sure. "The distilled spirits authorized under the subdivision may be sold by the farm winery at on sale or off sale, comma, in retail, comma, or in wholesale lots."
And yes, Senator Metzen.
Yeah, how does this, I'm not opposed to this, but Mr. Stang, maybe you know, we've got in Minnesota the three-tier system. The manufacturers, the wholesalers, and the retailers. Now, apparently they're going to be manufacturing this stuff or producing it. Do they have to, according to existing law, then sell it directly like to the retailer or the wholesaler? They can't be a wholesaler and a retailer? Or is this a deviation?
This is a deviation from the classic three-tier system. The farm winery statute currently is an exception. Brew pubs are an exception. There's a number of exceptions to the basic three-tier structure in statute. And this represents another one.
Okay, I understand. And that's basically a small enough thing where we can kind of turn our heads a little ways. And we've done some other things, but...
So, and Senator Tomassoni, you would like that amendment.
Right.
And I think I'm going to ask right now if anybody would like to speak to the bill. I see.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
They are already dealing with this product because brandy is a stronger wine and cognac is a stronger brandy. So they're already dealing with the basic product.
Yeah, same price. Okay. Extension of the product. Do you need a motion or?
You move the amendment. Senator Metzen moves the amendment as read by Mr. Stang. Nobody wishes to testify. Any more questions, members? All those in favor of the Metzen amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. And then we have. 3484 is amended. Is there anybody that wanted to testify, Senator Tomassoni?
I don't have anybody.
Anybody in the room wish to speak to it? Doesn't look like it. Then, members, the motion by Senator Metzen, if that's agreeable, that Senate File 3484 as amended be recommended to pass and... Incorporated into Senator Scogin's Senate File 3670. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You. And, you know, I think we can...
Well, you want to do dibbles first?
I don't know what this does procedurally to... This bill, of course, wouldn't be part of the...
No, this isn't a liquor bill.
You sell liquor at your...
I think we can...
Yes.
I think we can interrupt, if it's not too awkward, to deal with a separate bill. That's fine. Okay, members can handle this. Okay. If you can, then I better. Senate File 3685, Senator Thomasoni and Mr. Ledoux, welcome to our committee.
Well, one of the things I wanted to do was reintroduce ourselves, seeing that Sparks and Fireworks are together.
Yes.
I think we should be called Glove and Headgear.
And you don't have to let him talk anymore.
Okay, Senator Thomasoni.
Madam Chair, I think we have a delete all amendment to the file number 3685. It's an AO8 amendment.
You have it? Oh, do I have it? We have it. Okay, I'm sorry.
That one.
Here it is. 808-1340. Does it say up there? Yeah. Okay. Senator Scogin would move the author's amendment to put the bill in the shape we'd like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. You have the bill the way you would like it now. The amendment is adopted.
Go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll go through it real quickly what the amendment does, and it does four main things. The name of the Boxing Commission is changed to the Combative Sports Commission. There's editorial changes throughout the chapter for consistent use of the term Combative Sports Commission. It adds definitions for terms related to the name of the sports change, like combative sport contest, and it amends definitions to clearly define areas within the combative sports like professional boxing, amateur and professional tough persons, the amateur mixed martial arts, and the current jurisdiction of the commission. In rulemaking, it permits rulemaking related to combatants, combative sports, and combative sport contests. It has fees in there. It reduces all professional license fees from $45 to $25, except for the promoters. And it sets all amateur license fees at $10, except for the promoter, who's at $100. And then there's an appropriation for $80,000, which is in the governor's budget recommendation. So that's basically what the amendment does. And I think Mr. Ledoux can tell us how this has been going, because last year we made some changes to the Boxing Commission, and I think they were pretty positive changes, and he's been doing a great job of running the show there. So I think he can probably comment on that.
I think
Mr. Ledoux,
that,
hello.
When we had oversight, took over oversight, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee, we took over oversight of MMA, and I had no idea of what that sport was going to do.
And that's mixed martial arts,
mixed
right?
martial arts, yes. And what happened was that we had five boxing events last year, and we're going to, I expect we'll have 30 this year, MMA bouts, 30 MMA fights. And now the promoter is trying to put together both boxing and mixed martial arts, which will enhance both sports. And I think that's going to really be exciting for Minnesota. And like I said, we had 30 events this year, and we're busy every weekend doing those events. And then right now we have a real blessing is that UFC is coming here to Minnesota on August 9th. UFC is headed by Mark Ratner, who I've known for 30 years. He served on the Las Vegas Boxing Commission. And now UFC is coming here. And when they came to Columbus, Ohio, this is the first time they did a show outside of Vegas. They had 5,700 people at the weigh-in.
And UFC stands for?
United Ultimate Fighting Contest.
Ultimate Fighting Contest.
And then they had 19,800 at the event. That's unbelievable. It's just, and that will mean a lot to our state to help promote mixed martial arts, and I think that'll really produce a lot of events. I expect that next year, from July on, we'll probably have 40 mixed martial arts events, and probably 8 or 10 boxing events. I can't imagine we can get any more in, with our commission. So
Mr. Ledoux, last year or two, I'm trying to remember. I know we were in room 123 when we did the meeting because I can remember the hearing. But we brought mixed martial arts into your jurisdiction.
Correct.
But we didn't rename where we said, we just kept saying boxing throughout.
Correct.
Instead of specifically including it in some of your regulatory authority, I guess.
Correct. And now that's the reason for the change. Combative Sports Commission, which is a great analogy of our sports, boxing, mixed martial arts, you know, Muay Thai, stuff like that. That's really a great analogy and covers all the sports from karate to Muay Thai, kickboxing, all those things.
Do you think I've seen Muay Thai? Well, I don't know.
Muay Thai is a much more vicious sport than mixed martial arts. And it's
okay.
Pretty brutal. It's pretty rough. But it's interesting is that in the last 9 years where MMA has taken over our country, it shot past boxing in popularity. There's only been one death in mixed martial arts, and each year in boxing we have five around the world. And in one death, and it was just recently in Houston where the guy died 6 weeks after the mixed martial arts fight, but he was not in a coma or anything, and we don't understand why it was put on mixed martial arts back. So,
okay.
It's a great sport in that, as I've witnessed many fights, I've been to about 30 events already, and it's interesting, when a guy gets in a submission hold, he gets to tap out. He gets to tap out, and the referees stop, and we have such sensational officials. I saw a guy get kicked in the face, out cold, went down, and the other opponent dropped down to hit him, and the referee dove and knocked him off. And that's really, it's an interesting sport. And back in the day, I would have not participated.
Okay, no.
I would rather fight George Foreman every day than get kicked in the head. So.
Oh, I think so.
It's a tough sport.
And Madam Chair, I might add that he did fight 11 world champions when he was fighting, so he has some experience at it. And
I always say the good news is I was never knocked out. The bad news is I remember everything.
Well, I used to watch the Friday night fights with my grandpa.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
and, you know, that was kind of fun, and now I love ninja movies, and so I'd probably like this Muay Thai stuff.
Oh, you'd like that. Yeah. The interesting thing is, years ago I gave my life to Christ, and then I realized boxing was a Christian sport. It's much better to give than receive.
Words of wisdom. So we have the bill as amended. Do members have any questions? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to this? I don't think we're. Are we authorizing anything new that we weren't before, that we didn't anticipate? Are we just naming those things? Because did we have?
We're changing the name of the sport and the commission, and we're also changing the fees, lowering the fees because of the nature around Wisconsin and Iowa and North Dakota, which surround our state, their fees are much lower, and we're getting a lot of people that are going across the border to put those shows on, which we would like the revenue for.
And you said this is part of the governor's budget.
The $80,000 is, Madam Chair.
Okay. So the bill would go to finance, though.
No? You like that one?
Oh, yes.
I think they're selective.
Senator Rest wants it first. Is that,
oh, really?
I think so.
Okay, are they waiting for this bill then to come out so that it can go to Senator Rest?
We gotta get it out.
You have a deadline issue.
Yeah.
4 o'clock. I think it's 4 o'clock. We're
today?
Yes.
I don't know that we can
pull that off, but
get it there that fast. But we'll hurry things up here right now.
I do not have a request from Senator Rest, but I don't have anything in mind.
Did you get a request?
We don't have one, but that...
So the boards and commissions and stuff.
Pardon me?
It's going to be done, then.
So the department...
Can't make it.
...has said that it needs to go there. Is there... Is it changing a board or adding members or doing that kind
We're
of...
We're not adding members.
Okay.
We've added them.
There's some rule. There's some rulemaking in there, I guess, so...
Take it out.
Gotta go.
Probably a good idea.
You delete it?
Need the rulemaking?
Need to take it out?
Yes.
Take it out and set it on the floor.
She'll just request
it. Is anybody here... is this within labor and industry? Which department are you... Yeah, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Pat Munkel-Olson. I'm a lawyer with the Department of Labor and Industry, and I have been helping the Boxing Commission with its rulemaking and to some degree with the bill. And do you have a question about the rulemaking authority?
We need
is
it.
That, yeah.
Yes, it is important that you have the rulemaking authority. That
okay.
It remain in
then
the
you
bill.
Don't have a choice.
And I'd be happy to explain why, if that's... The commission in its rulemaking, one, has new subject matter because of this new kind of all-encompassing term, combative, what that means for combatants and so on. And so there is some changes to existing rulemaking authority to allow that to move forward. There are some critical timing issues. And so it does require publication of a notice of intent. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous. A notice of intent to adopt by a particular date. And it also, in the earlier legislation, certain unified rules and the rules of the American Boxing Commission was required to be adopted through the rulemaking process. This bill would permit certain modifications to make those appropriate for use in Minnesota. And so it is also important that the commission have the ability to make those amendments as necessary.
And Madam Chair, Senator Rest is having a hearing tomorrow. So
okay. Okay, so then I think we're fine as long as we can get this reported out of here and to the floor by before we adjourn today.
Okay.
Then you should be fine. So... then members.
Move it.
Senator
I'll move it.
Senator Sparks moves that Senate file 3685 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to State and Local Government Operations Committee. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the bill is
Through, Madam Chair.
Recommended to pass, and it's going to Senator Rest Committee, and we'll hurry that along.
Thank you.
Senator
thank
Tomasoni,
you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Mr. Ledoux.
Commissioner.
And now we're coming. Excuse me.
Another job.
Commissioner.
Yeah, Commissioner.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 3280.
Yes, and Senator Dibble, I don't know if you knew that we're going to incorporate bills into a bill being carried by Senator Scogin. Is that
well? That's great.
Acceptable to you?
That's wise.
Yes, in case we, you know, if we don't pass Senator Scogin's bill, your bill is in trouble. But
I think I'm for Senator
so
Scogin's
far, we've
bill.
Been.
You like that bill. You haven't seen it, but you like it.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 3280 allows the City of Minneapolis at its discretion, going through its normal process, to an on-sale intoxicating liquor license to a new restaurant that will be going in at 1367 Willow Street South. Madam Chair, that's the former Idle Hospital site that's now being transformed into, yeah, by Loring Park on the eastern boundary of Loring Park, that's being converted to condos. What else in my district? Amazing we still have condo projects going up given the market, but we do. And it's has been through some process already in terms of conversation and communication with the neighborhood organization, the affected neighbors, the city council member who represents the area. They are all in support. Nevertheless, there will be a full round of public hearings and findings and there's still a whole formal process to undertake at the city level. Joe Bagnoli is here, is representing the developer and the liquor license request.
Mr. Bagnoli.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble has summed it up very well. The city is supportive, the neighborhood organization is supportive, and we're hopeful to have another fine restaurant in the city of Minneapolis.
I'm curious because I thought the cities had this ability without us. Maybe you can explain that for us, Mr. Bagnoli.
Madam Chair, members, the issue here is they do, under normal circumstances, this, as you may know, around Loring Park is a little park that's somewhat near the Guthrie/Walker. There is a number of churches. Well, there's two churches. And a
rather large churches.
Rather, the Episcopal Cathedral of St. Mark's is right there, as well as one other one. And there's a school,
Basilica of St. Mary.
Basilica of St. Mary.
Yes.
And there are a number of those churches. There's restrictions in distance to them. There are a number of liquor licenses that have been granted that have gone through the same process at the legislature, one for the Walker, one for 510 Groveland, one for the Women's Club. And so this is yet another one in that little area that just happens to be because of the history of the city.
And at least two of them drink wine or offer wine, right? I know they do. I know the cathedral does.
Well, good Catholics that they are. Yeah.
So I understand. So,
also,
Senator Metzen moves that Senate File 3280 be recommended to pass and incorporated into Senate File 3672. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to this bill? No, there isn't. So, discussion, members? On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Dibble, thank you for your patience. Mr. Bagnoli, thank you. And now we have the Senator Scogin filing before us. Senate File 3672. And
I'd recommend that it, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor, I believe.
Senator Scogin moves that Senate File 3672 as amended, and members understand it has four provisions now. We recommend to pass and it would go to the floor. Any further discussion? Anybody want to comment from the audience? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the bill's recommended to pass.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah.
And we're doing really well.
Yeah.
We're down to needing Senator Olson and Senator Sparks, and I think
Sparks
we'll start.
Sparks.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Are we doing fireworks?
Huh?
I guess not.
Oh.
Really?
That would have to go to public safety. I think it can be that one.
It would have to go to public safety.
Yeah. They have jurisdiction over the fire marshal. Statute. They were asking me why we had the bill.
Because we always do fireworks.
That was my answer. That's exactly
okay.
What I said.
We're just in recess here for a few minutes till people come back.
Gavel. All right, come on here.
You'll come right back, Senator Kerr.
I'll wait a minute.
You're back. Thank you. The Commerce Consumer Protection Committee will come back to order here. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to apologize for holding you up. As you know, I was down in the Judiciary Committee dealing with an issue down there, and I appreciate your patience. I'm here today on behalf of Senate File 3508, which would require insurance companies to use the time allocations and compensation amounts indicated by the repair estimating systems that they require the repair industry to use. Virtually every insurance company now requires the use of estimating systems to standardize the repair process. And these estimating systems, by the way, are quite expensive to purchase and implement, so a lot of money has been invested by these companies to satisfy this requirement by insurance companies. Repair shops purchase and maintain these manuals or software programs to comply with this requirement by insurance in the insurance industry. The concern in this bill is seeking to address the selective use of estimating system information. The objective is to require the consistent use of these systems throughout the repair process. I have a witness from the repair industry who can provide additional information, and I'm sure that the insurance industry has witnesses here as well. Thank you.
Senator Olson, thank you. Are you saying that the insurance company is requiring this technology be used?
Madam Chair, that's correct. They, in order for people in the repair business to be competitive and to interact with the insurance industry, they are required to purchase the software that basically electronically determines the amount that they will pay. But the selective use of these manuals or information means that that basically we don't have uniform results, and they're basically negotiating off of the information that's in the repair manual rather than accepting the bids or the amounts that this information would provide should be the accurate amount that they would be paying. And so so that's kind of and Mr. Schoonover can give you more details and provide information about exactly how this works.
Okay, welcome to our committee. And if you just identify yourself, and I don't know if you have to spell your last name or not. Maybe you should.
Thank you. My name is Mike Schoonover. Last name is spelled S-C-H-O-O-N-O-V-E-R.
There, thank you.
You're welcome, thank you.
Mr. Schoonover.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schoonover. I am President and CEO of Schoonover Bodyworks and a member of the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers of Minnesota. My collision repair shops are located in Shoreview and Stillwater. I am a third-generation owner of our 70-year-old family business. I want to thank Senator Olson for authoring this bill for you today, Senate File 3508, which would prohibit insurers from selectively employing the estimating systems which have become a required part of doing business in the collision repair market. Currently, collision repair shops must use certain estimating programs. Insurers specify which programs or program they will accept, and the repair shop must purchase software and the manual for that program. These programs cost hundreds of dollars per month for shops to use. Many shops are forced to subscribe to two and even three of these programs. These estimating programs establish standards with respect to time, commitment, and cost of effecting repairs on virtually every make and model of vehicles on the road today. However, in recent years, the repair industry has seen some selective use of the estimating systems by insurers. On the one hand, insurers insist on having the repair shops rely upon this information when preparing repair estimates and settling claims. Then, in some cases, insurers seek to modify the procedures, time allocations, or compensation amounts associated with these estimating systems. This manipulation takes many forms, including arbitrarily marking down labor repair times and imposing caps or thresholds for paint and material reimbursements. Insurers regularly fail to recognize additional repair options when they are clearly not included in the documented procedure and are intended to be added separately. When these values are arbitrarily reduced, the shop loses revenue on the labor performed and the materials required to do a quality job. Technicians' wages are also reduced. Collision shops and the technicians who perform the quality repairs cannot continue to absorb these costs. Some shops are charging the customer for the difference, while most shops lose money by absorbing these additional costs. This cannot continue to happen. Insurers must adhere to the estimating guidelines so repairs can be made in a quality manner where shops do not lose money, technicians do not work more for less, and customers are not forced to pay the difference. If this does continue, the stark reality is more collision shops will be forced to reduce employee training and education, cut wages and benefits, eliminate jobs, or go out of business. Since the repair industry is mandated to use these systems and there is a mechanism for seeking adjustments to programs that vary from market conditions, we strongly support the notion that these programs should not be arbitrarily manipulated as insurers determine what they will pay a repair shop when settling an automotive claim. In this case, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. If we are going to adhere to the data within these estimating programs, so should the insurance industry. That is what Senate File 3508 does, and we would appreciate your support for this bill. Thank you for the opportunity for me to testify today, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Schoonover, thank you for being here. I do have a question. Can you just tell me how it works? Somebody comes in, their car is towed in, and you need to repair it. I assume this is for auto body repair kinds of things.
That is correct. Okay. That is correct, Madam Chair.
So do you use the system, whether it's a manual or an electronic system, to get an estimate? Maybe you can tell me what happens then with this system and how it goes back and forth with the insurance company.
When you leave the Capitol today and you accidentally bump into a post on your way out of the parking lot,
mm-hmm.
and you bump your bumper and do damage to it, you need to have an estimate made upon that damage. What happens currently is you will go to your repair shop of your choice and have an estimate done, and the shop will identify what that damage is and give you a cost associated with that as competitively as possible, because the shops are competing amongst each other to stay competitive, try to keep the consumer from paying a lot of money. However, when the insurers step in, usually the repair cost is going to be less because the insurer elects to arbitrarily reduce some of the labor operations that the shop needs to do, such as extra compensation for the painter to tint colors or to blend a panel to make the color match.
So you use this manual or this system to look and see what should be required for that task, right, for that job. Is that right?
That is correct. And let's just refer to it as the electronic version.
So you don't relay that, though. You just tell the customer, this is based on this system of figuring out the cost. This is what it will offer to do it the job for.
That is correct.
And if the insurance company wants you to use that system, they require that you use that system.
That is correct. There's one of three systems that are utilized in our industry today.
I think they're named in here. The CCC.
CCC, ADP, or Autotex, and Mitchell.
Okay.
And those are databases that are generated, that are widely used around the country by insurers and shops.
Okay.
And that's how we determine when you back into that pole, we determine what the cost of the parts are going to be and what the cost of the labor associated with putting those parts on or doing the repair or refinishing that particular part.
So now the customer says, okay, Mr. Schoonover, I'd like you to do this work. And they know that you're going to do it for X number of dollars. What happens now?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Could you repeat the question?
So the person decides they want to use your service. You know, they're going to come to you to have this repair work done. Now what happens? Do you now get authority or authorization from the insurance company?
Madam Chair, what happens? It could go a couple of different ways. If you are running it through an insurance company that, in my particular shop, if you bring your let's just use me as an example, and if I have a agreement with an insurance company to be a quote-unquote direct repair shop,
okay,
you would tell your insurance company that you want to bring your vehicle to my shop. At that point, once we find that out, then we make a change in the estimating that your specific insurance company is paying for that repair. And there are changes that are made within the database at that time, as agreed upon by the shop and the insurer, that we have to bring the estimate down to not include some particular operations that we would normally do. And then we schedule you for a repair.
Okay, and in any case, it's always less than what the program itself said it would be or should be.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Do members have any questions? Or concerns. So is there anybody else who would like to testify on this? Mr. Johnson. Welcome.
Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And I represent companies that write most of the auto insurance sold in the state here. And Madam Chair, a couple of things I'd like to comment on. And I don't have the specific expertise of an adjuster, so there are aspects to this I'll not be able to answer. I hope to try to have somebody here today who could help with that if these questions came up. But this actually is, Madam Chair and committee members, this is a very significant bill. And I fear it's starting us on a course that we haven't been on in Minnesota between auto insurers and body shops, collision repair shops in the state. We have actually, through the years, been able to work out many issues in informal settings, meeting between members of the two industries, and then brought to this legislature agreed to resolutions or, you know, compromises on key issues raised. I hope we can keep that process going. But I think with this bill, Madam Chair, and this is actually based on, if not directly, comes from the state of Rhode Island, which is a very contentious state in terms of the poor relationships between collision repair shops and auto insurers. And actually, Rhode Island is the highest priced state of the 50 states for collision repairs. And I think in terms of the bill and its impact, Madam Chair, if members could look at the language, I think what the comment I'd make, and as I've talked to some auto insurers, while these guides are intended to help provide some uniformity, some certainty, some a broad database to give an indication of what is, in fact, an appropriate amount of time or labor or cost for a repair, these are not rigid guidelines. In other words, a car comes in and cars and their damage and their age and what do you need to do to fix it? There is a discussion. There's a people factor that should continue to be a part of the process. And I fear that with this language in terms of requiring, and as you go through each one of them, and some of the language is specific, some of it's quite vague and ambiguous, and I'm not certain what all is pulled into this bill. And I really don't want to, I think it'd be a mistake to pull into Minnesota law here ambiguous phrases or clauses or references that nobody knows what they mean or to what they refer. In other words, on Clause 7, the new Clause 7, if you look at the bill, there's a reference, what was commented on, the CCC Mitchell audit text. Now, those are specific ones. We know what they are, but or any automated appraisal system related. Any, but by who? By who's going to draft that? I'm just saying that there's language in the statute that if the words in there are ambiguous, then what comes under that law is subject to, you know, some subsequent whatever fight, action, lawsuit. I think if you look at Clause 8, it prohibits us from failing to use a manual or system. Whose manuals? Whose systems? In their entirety, in the appraisal of a vehicle. Clause 9, refusing to, and I think as I read Clause 9, it looks like it's only intended to be painting and refinishing materials, but refusing to compensate an auto body shop for documented charges as identified through industry-recognized software programs. Whose industry? Is there anybody reviewing, approving, looking at the compilation of industry software programs? And Madam Chair, I would like to hand out, if I can, have somebody help, an example of why we care and why ambiguity in the law, I think, is going to create some potential problems down the law if this is adopted. And I think you have in front of you an example of something we printed off the internet. And it's a system body shop office. Here's an example of a software system with a tutorial on how to do billing. And if you turn to page 11 of that tutorial, so it's clearly readily available, and it's sold around the country, as I understand it. And the referencing there, if you walk through it, it says, okay, this feature will make you money. It will pay for this software with just a few uses. Some may think what you're about to see is dishonest, but you must remember the insurance company has no legal right to see your invoices, any invoices. They are private business documents. You don't show your customer how much you pay for parts. Why would you show the insurance company? Remember also that those list prices are manufacturer's suggested list prices. for those insurers that insist on seeing an invoice before they will pay you, here is your answer to their bully tactics. And then it walks through how you construct a new invoice to load a higher price in, collect more for that repair. And I put it before the committee just to indicate that, again, broad references in a statute to recognize software programs without knowing who's putting them together, if there's any kind of oversight approval looking at it, cause us serious concerns, because this is going to control, and this is going to be the law that all auto insurers are going to be subject to when they're handling collision repairs in the state of Minnesota. And for us, Madam Chair, we also handed out, just to remind committee members, of the average annual premiums in Minnesota, and just showed us some of our neighboring states. What we do in the law is going to affect what consumers pay in their premiums. And I'll end, Madam Chair, with just a little bit of history, because we've had examples in the past where we've made mistakes in this area as a state. And some of you that have been around remember our auto glass wars that we had in Minnesota. We had a lot of years of auto glass wars. And so what's the state of affairs today in Minnesota? We pay the highest windshield prices of all 50 states, period. It costs more to put a windshield on a Ford Taurus in Minnesota than 49 other states. Well, I don't know if that's good or bad. The point of the matter is it contributes to the cost of the premium. And I think for us, and it also ended up, and this is the example I'll end on, and I know no one's intending this, but no one intended it to happen in auto glass either, that the way the law was written a few years back because of the ambiguity in that auto glass law, we ended up having an auto insurer, and I think I probably testified to this situation at this committee in this room, where an auto insurer got a bill for a windshield for $5,300. They denied it. They asked the company if they could pay the blue book on the car, which was $4,500. This is for a windshield, eight-year-old Nissan. The company denied it. It was submitted to the Commerce Department. Commerce ordered the company to pay the $5,300, which was over the blue book. And those were the cases that precipitated going back in and undoing an ambiguous law that actually was causing a lot of money to flow that shouldn't have flowed. I know that that's not the intention. My concern is that by locking in a process that needs the people factor to it in terms of adjustments, and if insurers are failing in that regard or are making not doing the kinds of things, like I said, you know, I'm not aware, but we haven't been able, you know, I don't know that. I mean, obviously people are saying that that's an issue. But I really do have a concern, Madam Chair, that language that loads in ambiguous phrases that really are not, you read the words the way they are written there, and I think it opens up this law to a lot of downsides and documents that probably shouldn't.
Senator Olson and I have a question for Mr. Johnson, too. But Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, why don't I'll defer to your question, and then
well,
I'll
I wanted to ask if I think that it is vague and a little little open here, open-ended as to what could be used. Because what's on the handout is pretty shocking. But if an insurer requires a specific system of estimating costs, then, Mr. Johnson, would it be unreasonable to require them to reimburse based on that system, that they require, you know,
Madam
the repair
Chair,
shop.
I think I'll give you my best understanding, and if I'm not right on this, my best understanding is that while these systems are required, not rigidly applied. In other words, cars come in, and there is communication back and forth between the shop and the adjuster, and if some part of the work needs, you know, this adjustment needs to be made to fix the car. Remember, our legal obligation under the contract is to return the car to its pre-damage condition. That's our contractual requirement. So we have to do that, period. So now the process commences to return it to the pre-damage condition. I think when the car is there, and the estimating software, these systems are in place to give the guides, it's not my understanding that it's a rigid automatically apply it that way, that there is a give and take and a discussion between the shop and the adjuster to get to that. I think the direct repair programs that were referenced right up front before I got up, those are really good arrangements, as I understand it, for the shops involved, because they get volumes of business in exchange for agreements with the insurers, and they don't have to enter into them. They enter into them because they're favorable to generate a lot of business for those shops, and it's pretty clean, paperless system, seamless system for the consumer, because now the shops and the insurer have agreed to work out the full repair process. So I think the DRP programs are, I believe, they're beneficial for consumers, for shops in the insurance industry, just because of those contractual agreements that they entered into. But again, that's my understanding, as I have talked to some people, you know, from my members that work with this process, it's not a rigid hit the button and this is going to apply automatically and every time for this particular damage on this kind of car. So when you get in and look at the damage, then there is a give and take back and forth between the insurer and the shop to arrive at, you know, what's the work that needs to be done to return it to the pre-damage condition, and then how much, you know, what are the costs to do that.
So it would seem like I bought a car that had a different color, kind of a tone in the trunk, and we found out that it had been made as a sedan, and they made it into a convertible at the factory, and they damaged the trunk, and so they had to repaint it. Well, it was not painted the same tone. One was kind of sparkly, and the trunk was sparkly, and the rest of the car wasn't. And I did, you know, they finally fixed that for me, but it sounds like they're having trouble with that kind of issue. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to address some of the things that Mr. Johnson has said, and then also try to shed a little light, and perhaps Mr. Schoonover can as well, on how this comes up. But I'd first of all say that in terms of a concern that the insurance industry might have about the car repair shops going online and picking something like the handout that we received from Mr. Johnson, there's nothing in number 7 and 8 that say that the insurance industry is bound by any particular estimating system at all. The idea, however, is that when they have agreed to and required the insurance or the repair shop to use a particular estimating system, that they cannot use it selectively or modify it because it's setting the standards. That's what those systems are all about. They're to determine how many hours are reasonable, for example, to do a certain thing, to do a certain type of repair, and it's setting the standard of what's acceptable and reasonable within the industry. And the insurance industry has agreed to use that manual, in fact required that the repair shop use that manual. But then to come back in after the fact, what this is getting at is saying that you can't come in back in selectively after the fact and say, well, we required you to have that manual and we require you to use it and we require you to follow its guidelines in terms of how many hours you say that it's, or it says you're going to take to do these certain things, but now we're going to come in and we're going to try to negotiate downward from there, and where the manual says it's going to take 3 hours to do this certain repair, we're only going to allow two. Or that the cost of a certain thing is a material is going to be X, we're only going to pay this much. And so basically what it's doing is it's setting the standard, and then it's still giving itself kind of all the cards are in its hands in terms of limiting what the bid can be to begin with and then not abiding by its own rules. To me, this is the analogous thing that I dealt with a lot would be on medical bills, where insurance companies will come in and kind of arbitrarily decide that something is not reasonable or customary in terms of the charges they're going to pay, and then reducing medical bills and leaving the customer or the medical facility without in the middle of an argument where they're supposed to be paying the actual cost and yet they're looking for ways to reduce their obligation. when you have an industry standard that they've agreed to abide by and a manual that they've agreed to use, it seems only fair that it's going to cut both ways, as Mr. Schoonover has said. And there's really no ambiguity in that. I mean, I don't know where the ambiguity in those paragraphs would be, or in Section 7 and 8 could possibly be. And if there were some, I certainly haven't seen any suggested language from the industry that would allow me to address those ambiguities, although I don't see them. With respect to subsection 9, that says, refuse to compensate an auto body shop for documented charges as identified through industry-recognized software programs or systems for paint and refinishing materials. So, you know, that isn't as specific in terms of it having to be something that they would have agreed to beforehand, but it does say it has to be industry-recognized software programs. I would not be adverse to adding language if there is a concern that somehow something is, even though it says it has to be industry recognized, but if we were to add some language to say that it has to be recognized by and accepted by the insurance industry as well, I think the concern here is that they can't be selectively using this information and that we have to be fair to both sides. And so that's what that's what this bill is attempting to do, not to take advantage, not to pull out things off the internet that, you know, that they haven't agreed to or recognized as acceptable, but simply to say that if they're recognizing something and requiring the body shops to use it, we shouldn't have to have these arguments either between body shops and insurance companies or between customers and insurance companies, because there's an arbitrary reduction that isn't justified by the industry standards.
Well, Senator Olson, I mean, obviously there is an issue in the industry that the auto repair shop people have come forward with, you know, mm-hmm. in wanting this bill. I think item 7 is pretty open. Any automated appraisal system relating to auto body repair would be then this body shop solutions would qualify, you know. And so I think that you need to tie it to something that's approved by the insurer itself. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, it simply says they can't modify these. It doesn't say the insurance industry has to accept them. And so if the insurance industry hasn't recognized or accepted one of a later system that they might decide they want to use, and I think that's why the OR is added to this, because the insurance industry might want to use a different system, but there's nothing in this that requires them to accept any particular system. It just simply says they can't modify a system. So if they have accepted a system, they're going to have to abide. They can't be selectively choosing within that system. I would say, you know, if it makes...
You okay with it?
Instead of A&A, just say industry recognized.
Okay. Madam Chair, we could say or industry recognized or insurance industry recognized automated appraisal system. But really, there's nothing in this language that requires them to accept anything. It's just simply saying that they can't modify it if they have it. And that's the intent, because there's no other paragraph here that says they have to accept any of these systems, just simply that they can't modify them.
But nevertheless, they would be required to. If they didn't agree with something, you know, there's not any room for, you know, even negotiation there. But Senator Dahl.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this actually is pretty scary. And when I look at things like this and knowing I've had invoices before or estimates, I go, wow, where did that come from? I'm wondering if this legislation... Senator Olson or Mr. Johnson, I would like to think the consumer would benefit by a balance between what the body shop believes is a fair price and what the insurance company believes is a fair price, and I'm not sure that this is going to keep that balance. I believe the adjuster and the body shop maybe would find that better balance for the consumer, one wanting to keep the price low, one wanting profit.
Mr. Johnson.
Senator Dahl, just a comment, and I think, again, we have to return contractually, legally, we have to return it to the pre-damage condition. I think what the consumer wants, do that so it's done and they don't have to redo it. do it in a way so that it's cost-effective because they pay it in their premiums. The consumer is not going to be, you know what I mean, involved in this process other than, really, as you look on Clause 1 of current law, they have the freedom to choose wherever they want to go. So by state law, an insurer cannot, you know, force or direct or tell me if my car is damaged, you know what I mean? So that right's there. And at that point, I think it's fair to say, I mean, I've had cars fixed before, and I go to the shop in Osseo near my house, and I trust they're, you know what I mean, they're going to do the job, and they'll work it out with the insurer. I think the disconnect here for me seems to be, and is that this is a people business where there is a discussion and interaction, and if a car comes in and it's damaged and this manual says X number of hours for some sort of struck repair, and there's something less than that that needs to be done once you get in to actually do it, the automated system isn't going to be able to identify it that way. As soon as you click off strut, and if it's, I don't know the numbers, if it says 4 hours, and it can be done fully to restore it in 2 hours, I don't think we want 4 hours of labor built in. So there is kind of a give and take back and forth between the adjuster and the shop, and that seems to me to be a healthy process. And I think these automated systems, I believe they're important, but they're important for reference guides where they get broader data. This Mitchell International, this is collecting information surely from throughout the United States. Maybe it is international, but I know it's nationwide. So, again, we're trying to aggregate a lot of data for kinds of repairs, what's the kind of amount of hours that you need. But until you actually get in and actually rip the part out and actually look at it, it may not require the amount of hours specified. So isn't that a give and take back and forth between the shop and the adjuster to get to a final? The company is going to pay for whatever is necessary to return it to its pre-damaged condition, because if they don't do it that time, then they'll have to do it a second time until they accomplish that. So for us, there is a balancing act here, and we need to do it in a cost-effective way. The consumers aren't going to shop those numbers because people don't know how to fix cars in that sense. So it is going to be between the auto insurer and the adjuster. It just seems to build in a rigidity here that I don't think is going to be beneficial.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schoonover.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. What started this, I think there was a little bit of surprise on the insurers' industries from their point of view that this came out of nowhere. A year ago in the fall, a major insurance company, one of the largest insurance company, auto insurers, changed the way that they handle their business, and it changed their way of paying for claims, which turned our industry upside down. This particular insurance company had a mechanism, an annual mechanism, for setting labor rates in markets throughout the country. They stopped doing that, and that was the industry-accepted way of determining labor rates in a market. Since they changed that and since they eliminated that, we have no way of determining a labor rate increase. We need to abide by antitrust laws. We cannot meet as shops and say, what are your rates? We have no mechanism of doing that. However, the insurance industry is taking advantage of a lower claims count right now. There's fewer accidents than there were the year before and the year before that. Claims are dropping. Fewer customers are having their cars fixed. And this is putting a burden on repair shops. They have fewer cars in their shops. People are driving safer. Cars are built better. So there's not accident frequency is going down. So we have no mechanism of raising our quote-unquote rates to keep up with our costs of labor, materials, gas, taxes, you name it. So the only other mechanism is this here, that we need to be reimbursed and compensated for everything we do when we repair a consumer's car. We are not looking to gouge the customer. We are not. Our goal is not to raise their premiums. But if we don't do anything, we're going to have more and more people leave the collision repair market. We're going to have more and more shops close, and it's just not going to be a good avenue for the consumer, because the people that are left, the shops that are being hurt right now are the shops that are well-qualified, that train their employees, that fly above the radar, that are right there in front of everybody, that give good customer service. The only shops that are going to be left are the ones that repair vehicles in the back alleys under the radar and do it for whatever the insurer says. Now, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
No, I was going to say, Mr. Schoonover, can you quantify what it might give an example of an auto that you've fixed and what happened subsequent to fixing it and the reimbursement? I mean, well, I think there's a problem here. Senator Olson, in all sincerity, I don't think that this language does what I think it does more than you mean it to, but it needs some work. But Mr. Schoonover, can you kind of quantify for me?
Madam Chair, all we want to do is we want to get reimbursed and compensated for what we do to our consumers' vehicles. We're not asking for anything more.
Mr. Schoonover, are you saying is there an agreed upon price with the insurance company before you start to do the work? Mr. Schoonover?
Madam Chair, in a direct repair agreement, if a claims adjuster from that direct repair company comes into my shop and says, we do not pay for that operation, or we need to reduce the time of that operation, just out of the blue, you need to do it. I need to abide by that, or the words ring loud and true with a lot of collision repairs around the country is, if you don't do it, there's somebody down the street that would love to take your place on this program. So it's fear tactics that keep shops on these direct repair programs because fewer claims out there, fewer cars to be fixed. You're not going to tell a large or a major insurance company that, you know what, I don't want to be on your program because I don't want to play by your rules. That's suicide. All we're asking is that the database that's provided that the insurance industry uses and the collision repair industry uses, that we just utilize it the way it was meant to be utilized.
But I'm assuming that sometimes something would take less time than maybe the manual says. I mean, I can imagine that could happen.
Madam Chair. Right. What we do is our industry is built on, well, that's a whole other subject, but we need our technicians to be very efficient in what they do, and they do beat the book times. So we send our technicians to training. They get educated. They get good at their skill. If they do it in lesser time, should we punish them? We've purchased all the equipment to do time-saving repairs, to do quality repairs, to turn vehicles around and get them back in the customer's hands as fast as possibly can with the highest quality possible and guarantee them for life. Why should a technician be punished if he does it in an hour less or 2 hours less than what the published time is? Now, that's just on that end of it. That's not the issue. The issue is just arbitrarily saying, We need to remove a couple tenths here and there, or a half hour here, or an hour there, because.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, first, I guess I just want to say again the reason I agreed to carry this bill is to try to provide fairness and balance on both sides. If the insurance adjuster were actually in a shop and there was something unique about the particular situation that required this FaceTime, and that were really the concern or what was happening out there, then I don't think this would be a defensible position to take. But the fact is that's not how these situations are coming up, and that's not what's happening. It's more, as Mr. Schoonover said, it's saying we're going to buy, you know, that this is a standard we're going to use, and then it's just saying across the board, now we're going to push you down from that standard, and we're going to shave an hour here or there, not because of a particular job's need to do that, but just because an over-the-phone conversation, you know, saying we're going to take this off the price or an arbitrary type of thing. So I'm very happy to modify the language in a way that would make it clear that we're not requiring them to abide by anything like this. I think it's already clear in the language, but if there's a concern that Senator Dahl and others have that this is the problem, then I think we can work on that. But I think the concern is that there's fairness and that there's not this arbitrary reduction of time or services or the cost that doesn't provide a fair balance between the parties.
Senator Olson, I think what I'm going to do, I think this needs some work, and it needs some collaboration, some discussion of the issues. Mr. Johnson, or with someone else from the industry that, you know, from a company that maybe could help get to the bottom of it. Because I certainly hear what Mr. Schoonover is saying in terms of if he's not being compensated for the work that's being done, that's an issue. That's not right. But I think we need work on the issue. I'm going to lay the bill over, Senator Olson, ask you to work on it. I've just been told that it's being heard in the other body tonight, so that means it could be back here, could be over here next week if that's the case. I mean, it's a possibility. And we are meeting next Tuesday, so if you could maybe put your heads together and work on this. I think we'd like to do something to help you get fully compensated for the work you're doing, but not tie the hands of any ability, I don't know if the word's negotiation, but sort of reasonable people coming together and deciding what's necessary and, you know, to get a car back to somebody in the shape it was before the accident. Senator Olson.
So, Madam Chair, I'm happy to follow that guidance, and I guess I'm just asking for some direction here. If what you're thinking is something that would limit the insurance company's ability to just make arbitrary reductions that would be not, you know, supportable by specific circumstances of the situation or something like that?
It may be that. I think Mr. Johnson is hearing the concern of the industry. Mr. Schoonover, I mean, I think you articulated it very well. So that we don't have a negative impact on the overall system, I think it would be good to narrow the language to do just exactly what we want to do. And I don't know if it's almost all, it looks like it must really be about painting and refinishing materials, but I'm sure that maybe isn't the only issue, but to actually specify that's, I can tell that's a real problem, apparently. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll talk to Senator Dahl as well and see if there's, you know, exactly find out from him what his concerns are and see if there's a way that we can come up with something that you're both comfortable with. And Senator Gerlach, certainly you too, but I don't know if you have any concerns with this bill or not. So
his opinion counts on this committee. So with that, then, we're going to lay over Senate File 3508, and it may come back next week after the deadline, after the House bills come over. And with that, before we go, I will tell members that we have, there's a couple of things that I want everybody to hear. Of course, not everybody is here, but Senator Olson's a member of this committee as well. I'm going to be asking the principals or the stakeholders in the payday lending to meet with me, including the authors, Senator Pappas and Higgins, to see if we can find some. I know we won't find complete, total, you know, common ground, but I think we can find some and then work from there. And I don't know, I'd be really surprised if we were able to work to do that before, you know, this year. I should just say I'd be surprised if we could. Next week, we have coming House files, and Senator Foley, 3204. It's a vehicle window glazing restriction exemption. Senator Dahl has a flood insurance coverage regulated and disclosures required. Senator Sparks has that's 3582. House file 1665 by Senator Sparks. Excuse me. Consumer reports, security freezes regulated. That doesn't tell me much. I don't mean to be vague. House File 2721 is also Senator Sparks, having to do with auto insurance and certain claims. I think it has to do with chiropractors. And then Senator Johnson has Department of Commerce bill on petroleum product standards. That's House File 3411. And so far, that's what we have scheduled. So with that, members, I appreciate those of you who hung in here. Thank you very much. The meeting's adjourned.